accession number 10420, rule 6.
Colonel W.I. Watson, Reel 6. Can you tell me, Colonel, of your immediate reaction on landing in France, in particular with the question of the civilian reactions to you?
Yes, I can. In the afternoon, after we'd landed, the three of us, the chaplain and the DAPM and myself, took a walk round the town, as we were not going to leave by the train to Evron, where we were going to, until late in the evening. And to us it seemed little better than the East End of London. It was dirty and untidy and not a cheerful welcome. The smell round the old port was disgusting, and the first impression of the French was that they have no aim in life and were a deteriorating nation. The best place, of course, was the station, which was built by the Germans after the First World War by way of reparations. And it was a magnificent building on the quayside. Now it was empty, except for troops. And what a contrast it was to the hum of life which must exist in peacetime, or must have existed in peacetime, when the great transatlantic liners used to call. We returned to the train round about 4:30 to ensure that all the men were present and ready for the journey. And we there got some tea and had a very long wait until 8:30, when the train was due to leave to Evron.
Can I just come in there, Colonel? When you were walking round the town, did the civilians in any way show any interest in you at all?
Not at all.
Just ignored you?
Ignoring. Yes. Yes. None whatsoever. On the station, I will remember talking to a pioneer battalion who were all foreigners. They were, it was an English pioneer battalion. They were Germans, Poles, and Czechs. And one orderly room clerk who was with them, who had been in a concentration camp, spoke fluent English, although only in England for a very short time. He learned English extremely quickly, I thought. And he'd been in the country as a refugee. Their outlook and hopes for the future couldn't have been very bright, but they all seemed extremely cheerful and very content to be working for the English and for England.
And did they speak English? Sorry.
Well, some of them half English.
Or something like an English Foreign Legion.
Yes. Yes. It's a Foreign Legion sort of type.
Did you say how that battalion had formed then, and how did it come about?
Well, they'd all been roped in and volunteered to join for navvying and or unloading or that sort of work, pioneer work.
It's fascinating because I hadn't realised that such a unit would have existed in the British Army.
Oh, Lord, yes. Good heavens, yes. And we met them there, and I had a talk with them. Now, there was a chap called Collingwood in the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers who was a brother of the famous one of the famous Collingwood family in Northumberland. brother of Sir Edward Collingwood, Professor Sir Edward Collingwood of Collingwood College at Durham University, and brother of Sir George Collingwood, who was GOC&T's Scottish command at one time. And this was a brother who was in the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers, and he was a bit of a wild chap, I think, and he should have been the OC train, but he never turned up till just before the train was going, and so I had to take on the OC train, but he very kindly, I always remember, brought me a bottle of champagne as a peace offering. There was trouble too. Oh, yes, I can remember it so well. There was trouble, too, over a stolen lamp, a railway lamp. Who'd stolen it or what happened to it? But the French made such a performance over this stolen lamp, which was never found. And then, typically French, there was a railway carriage in the train that had only one buffer, and that had to be taken out just when we were all ready to start. But why the train carriage had ever been shunted into the station with only one buffer, really, it was beyond me. But eventually we got going. And always in darkness, of course. The train was in complete darkness. And I think we went through Caen. I can't remember, but we were continually stopping. And it really was a most appalling journey. The cold whistle through these old railway carriages, through the floors and through the doors and through every single crack in the carriage. Fortunately, I had a blanket, and Tiny Guild had the most appalling cough. Coughed the whole way to Evron, and the bishop, the chaplain, sat in one corner with a balaclava helmet on and wrapped in a rug, taking swigs at his flask every now and then. But it was so cold, I can well remember chiseling off the ice, scraping the ice off the window panes with a hardtack biscuit, a ration biscuit, see if we could see through the windows. Well,
do you recall on the journey the accommodation that the other ranks had? They weren't in the old First World War.
No, they weren't in trucks.
No.
They were in carriages. I'm quite sure they were all in carriages, but it wasn't much better than being in trucks. As I say, the train stopped everywhere and at all hours, and when dawn broke, there appeared to be snow everywhere. But not until 11:30 did we arrive at Evron, frightfully tired and worn out, and the sight of Banks on the station made matters far worse for us all. Incidentally, we should have arrived at 8:30.
Have you any idea what day this is? What day are we on now?
We were on it's the 24th of January. Yes, it was the 24th of January. There was no suitable lavatory accommodation anywhere. I was in a very bad mood, I know. And I was shown my billet, which I shared with Tiny Guild, in a very icy room in a house belonging to a Madame Blanchard.
Can you describe your accommodation?
Well, it was just a bedroom. It was our bedroom. That's all we had.
Have you any idea as to where the troops were being billeted?
They were being billeted in similar accommodation, houses and schools and... Well, not schools so much, but church halls and anywhere like that.
And was the civilian reaction any better to having you with them?
No, the civilian the reaction was very poor.
They weren't particularly cooperative, were they?
No.
Can I ask you about the... Was there any question in your memory at all of looting or anything like that?
No.
Arising? The troops were well disciplined.
Oh, yes, yes. They were told to be, it was impressed upon everybody that they had to be very well behaved to the French. It doesn't say the French weren't well, all that well behaved to them, as I've got into your incidents.
Please do.
I will remember some Frenchmen coming in to see me. Frenchmen, I think. I think there was only one coming in to see me to make complaints. And I wasn't a fluent French speaker. I really didn't know what he was talking about. And suddenly, my two French liaison officers, Bézard, Lieutenant Bézard in particular, seized this chap and flung him out of the office. And I said, what on earth are you doing there for? And they said, well, if he'd spoken to us like that, we'd have given him worse. You didn't understand what he was talking about.
So he hadn't been very complimentary.
No, it hadn't.
Did you ever find out what his complaint was?
It was some complaint, I think, from the about the 4th East Yorkshire and their behaviour. Some regiments were battalions and were extremely good at cooperating with the French. But you've got some younger officers who thought they were God Almighty, and the cooperation wasn't all that good. Of course, the French were being particularly difficult. Very difficult indeed, they turned out to be, so far as the movement of the division was concerned, and just so far as I was concerned. Banks, as I say, was there on the station, and there was nothing much, when we got settled in, there was nothing much to do, but he was going round in small circles doing absolutely nothing. And I then went for the first day on the 24th, the first day in France, I went to bed early to get warm, although it was freezing hard outside, and my sleeping bag, which I'd brought with me, was really warm. Incidentally, there was a stove in our room, which, of course, we couldn't use because at night it was for carbon monoxide poisoning. But it was a coke stove, and we couldn't use it. Weren't Italian, and I weren't allowed to use it. Well, one of the first things I did the next day, I noticed in my diary, I got to work once more, and I arranged for a proper seat to be put in the loo, in the earth closet, in the headquarters, and the whole place cleaned out. So you can imagine what we were...
I was going to ask you about sanitation.
Yeah. It was all earth closet.
And what about the water? Was the water clean and drinkable?
No, it wasn't. No. You didn't drink the water. You took jolly good care that you always drank wine when you had to, unless it was boiled, of course. The weather was still frightfully cold. There was snow and ice everywhere. It was rather funny seeing French children sliding on the village pond. We had a small mess, division headquarter mess, instituted in a very drafty room at the back of division headquarters. Well, the division headquarters was in the village square, you might say, overlooking the Hotel de Ville, which was situated right in the middle of the village. And one thing I always remember was there was a French tricolour hanging out over the entrance to the Hotel de Ville, and it was made of tin. And when there was a roaring wind, when you would expect the tricolour to be blowing about in the wind, it remained absolutely motionless, folded as a a flag would look when there was no wind. And another thing, too, I can remember the town crier going round the village, and he had a drum with a handle on which he turned, and that worked the drumsticks, and it made a drumming noise, and then he shouted out his, like a town crier notice, to which nobody paid the slightest attention. And there used to be the market day there. Huge loads of hay used to be brought in, and it was weighed and then went off. It was weighed and sold and was sent in, sent off, I think, by train somewhere or other. And there would be chickens there and fowls and carp, fish, all alive. They were all so live weight. And the carp, fish were wrapped up in paper, all alive. And there was on one occasion, there was a chap there marking the horns of the cattle that were brought in, were just on a different day to the market day. And we watched him. And obviously he was frightfully good at branding the horns of these animals. But nevertheless, he had a horn mark right down his cheek and lost one eye through his experiences of trying to mark fractious cattle. But he was you looked out of the office on this typical French village scene. And then I started then, you see, the move tables for the division to start its move to its concentration area. And which was some 200 odd miles away, near Lille, on the borders of Belgium, of course, in Lens, or Lens, or whatever you call it. That was going to be the concentration area. But the weather rarely was the whole trouble from the beginning to end, and the lack of cooperation with the French authorities. We sent officers forward to make a reconnaissance of the route, and eventually Banks and the general all went forward to the new area. Banks was still frightfully difficult. He wouldn't lend Tiny Gill a spare lamp, which he had. You know, he wasn't going to lend Tiny Gill the lamp.
Can I just ask you at this stage, before you go on, before the division does move forward, the climate, did it have an effect on the troop health, on the troops' health?
Well, eventually it did, because a flu went through us like a dose of salt through our headquarters, and that was really why I got it bad there. I took no notice. I tried to struggle on with flu, and then of course it went to my lungs.
And what was there a problem? Was there a problem with washing and shaving? What water facilities did you have?
Nearly all the houses had water facilities, but as I mentioned later, you couldn't have a bath. There were no baths at all, unless you found somewhere where you could have a bath.
With regard to hotel. Discipline, and I'm speaking really about, I suppose, the division as a whole, really, was there an emphasis on the standard of appearance being kept up?
Yes, yes.
At all times, and kit being clean.
It was a great deal smarter, the chaps were, than the French were.
How long
the French were absolutely steeped in the Maginot Line, which is fatal.
And you got this opinion as soon as you got there,
Yes, they couldn't think of anything else because they were proud to be in the Maginot Line, a defensive line, which is fatal. I remember my landlady when I was in bed during having the flu, when I had this flu in bed, she lined our three sons up in front of me, proudly lined them up, and I said to each one, "Where are you stationed?" "Maginot Line." "Where are you?" "Maginot Line." All three in the Maginot Line.
And had you, early in your experiences in France, come across French troops?
Their troops? No.
So you hadn't yet formed an opinion about the French?
No. The only French officers that I'd come across, and they were all first class, amusing chaps, frightfully pro-British, of course, were the officers attached to division headquarters.
The Liaison. How long were you at this Evron, I think it's
Well, we were there a great deal longer than we ever were intended to be. When I left Evron, I can't remember now when it was, but it wasn't till well into February or even March because of the weather.
And the rest of the division in particular,
it was halfway
were around you?
No, where they were. Some were halfway there, some were, hadn't started, and others had got to the other end.
I see.
Because of the French stopping us moving on account of the danger we might do to the roads. And when they wanted to move a division across our front.
So you were scattered and broken
up? Oh, heavens, yes. Because that, I'll bring it out later. There's a general for 5 weeks telephoned to me every night. He was 200 miles away and I was in command of the division.
Well, I think the best thing I can say, Colonel, is you to take me through the rest of your time
story.
Here from your own memories now.
Yes. Well, I have to refer to my notes because they really are rather... It's a little complicated and a little difficult to remember all the details. there was a question, of course, to start with, which mess I would be in. I'd been in number one mess, which was the general's private mess, and then Banks started to be really difficult and thought I ought to go into the number two mess, which wasn't the general's mess. And then I went back finally into the general's mess. And I completed all the move tables, moving the whole division to its new assembly area on the 28th of January. And with the greatest relief to us all on that day, Banks left for the forward area round Lille and Lens, whatever they call it. Banks took with him the chief French liaison officer, Dubutre, he was called, and he won the MC in the First World War. He was a chasseur alpin in his lovely blue uniform and stockings and boots, and he'd won the MC with us in the First World War, and he'd won the Legion of Honor and the Croix de Guerre and the MM. He really was a first-class linguist and who entered Germany on the 3rd of September. He speaks very good English, and his mother was English. And so he got on like a house on fire with us.
Can you briefly tell me the duties and responsibilities of a liaison officer with
you? Oh, an interpreter, really, and cooperating with the French. He could understand English, and they all could understand English. I tell you, my liaison officer who was with me more than anybody else was a chap called Bézin, and he was Littlewood's Pool's representative in Paris, where he could, of course, speak perfect English. And he stood no truck with any of his fellow Frenchmen, but he was the one. I even went out rabbit shooting with him one day while we were waiting to move. Well, all the advance parties went up to this forward area round about the last day of January, the 29th of January, and they got to the forward area. Whilst the snow had melted with us, it was pretty bad up in the northern area. But then, just as everything was ready to start, the whole of the movement was stopped until the 3rd of February. The French weren't going to have us moving until the 3rd of February. And it was definitely to commence on the 3rd of February. Now you've got to remember the general, the banks, and everybody else was 200 odd miles away. And I was the only one left at divisional headquarters in charge of the whole of the 50th Division. And even the brigadier would come and see me. I remember the brigadier coming in one day just to see how everything was going. There was no mess, of course, and I moved into the RASC mess. And then came to join me the MAC, Major McCracken, who was the DAD mess, and a man called White, who was DADOS, Deputy Assistant Director of Ordnance Survey. And they came from the port, and it was a good thing to see their cheerful faces once more. You do know who McCracken was, you know? Well, he was brother-in-law to the famous Esther McCracken, who wrote the play The Quiet Weekend and The Quiet Wedding in Newcastle. And he was the brother-in-law, her brother-in-law. She married McCracken's brother, who was a stockbroker in Newcastle.
What position did he hold with you?
DADMS, Deputy Assistant Director of Medical Services. Now, by the 3rd of February, all the divisions had arrived in the assembly area and the back round Evron, and the last to arrive being the 74th Field Regiment. Now, their areas, I can give you, were as follows. Divisional headquarters and divisional signals and headquarters Royal Engineers and headquarters Royal Artillery and the 235 Field Company, Field Park Company, and the headquarters RASC were all round Evron.